Welcome to VFN TV and the daily VFN radio program, where we're keeping the conversation light. That's L-I-G-H-T, light, with your host, Greg Lancaster.
Welcome to VFN TV. I'm your host, Greg Lancaster, and joining me just a moment is John Ramos. Today, we're going to be talking about the author of Because They Hate, Bridget Gabriel, a woman who's just made it her, American woman, who's just made it her passion to educate us on what cost her her own country and almost destroyed her family. And she's going to share with you her testimony right here. And then we're going to join her when she spoke just the other day at the Value Voters Summit, explaining to us what she experienced and what true radical Islam is all about. This is Bridget Gabriel giving her testimony of what happened to her when she was in Lebanon with her family. Watch.
I came to America. I married an American who was a war correspondent while I was working in Jerusalem as news anchor. And this is how I ended up in this country. We got married in Jerusalem, had our first baby in Jerusalem. And then we came to the United States. And I thought I left all the crazies behind me. I left all those radicals behind me. I'm in America now. I'm going to have a brand new life. It's going to be so wonderful. I have made it to the promised land. Mm-hmm. And we did. My husband and I started our own little TV production company and a little business. And you know, we had a second child, so we lived in a beautiful little home with the picket fence. I mean, we had the American dream. And September 11th turned my life upside down. Mm-hmm. September 11th reminded me that the crazies I left behind have followed me here to the United States. Mm-hmm. And that's when I thought to myself, I mean, after September 11th, I laid on my family room couch for 7 days. I was devastated. I was frustrated. All of a sudden, all this pain came to the surface. Mm-hmm. All this agony, all the memories that I tried to suppress and forget about came to the surface. Mm-hmm. When I was watching the images of 9/11, as we all did on 9/11, we sat in front of our TV screens feeling so helpless, so frustrated, so in pain, so in agony, that how could people do this, something like this to us? And I remember watching the images of people being pulled from under the rubble, or parents screaming for their loved one, for their children, screaming their children's names, holding pictures. I remember people running around with pictures of their loved ones saying, have you seen this person? Have you seen this person? And watching the smoke come out of the buildings. And for me, it reminded me of when I was wounded, when I was trapped under a wall. I could smell the black powder. I can feel the heat of the fire around me. I drank my own blood. I was wounded in my arm. My arm was over my face. My face, the blood was in my eyes and my lips, and I could not I remember the taste of my blood as I bled, drinking my blood. I remember hearing the voices of my parents scream to me. So when I watched the images of September 11th, it did something to me different. It affected me differently than a lot of people who have not gone through that experience of a terrorist attack of that magnitude. And I laid on the couch thinking, what can I do? My daughter walked home on September 11th. I have two daughters. Mm-hmm. And she was around my age when this happened. And when I was wounded, she was 10 years old. And she walked home and she was looking at the TV screens. And she said to me, Mommy, why did they do this to us? Mm-hmm. And I found myself looking at my daughter and repeating to her exactly what my daddy told me in Lebanon back 30 years ago. They hate us because they consider us infidels and they want to kill us because we are Christians. Here we were, two generations apart, mm-hmm. two continents apart. Mm-hmm. I was a young Lebanese girl when I was her age, when I was wounded, who spoke the Arabic language, had a Lebanese passport. She's a young American girl who speaks the English language, has an American passport. 8,000 miles apart, two continents apart. Yet I found myself repeating to my daughter exactly what my daddy told me. Mm. That's the day that I became an activist. That's the day. That was my defining moment. Mm-hmm. September 11th was a defining moment for our country. Mm-hmm. That moment was a defining moment for me. Mm-hmm. That's the day I swore I will do everything I can in my power to make sure that my daughter will never ever look into her child's eyes and repeat to him or to her what my daddy told me and what I had to tell her. Mm-hmm. that's the day I was reborn as an activist. And I started thinking, what can I do to make a difference for my country? Mm-hmm. And I'm the type of person that I believe every single one of us in life has a purpose, mm-hmm. has a destiny to fulfill. Mm-hmm. We are here for a reason, for a season, for a purpose. And we go through trials and tribulations in life, and we do not know, why did God allow that to happen to me? Why did God allow that horrible, horrible bad thing to happen to me, mm-hmm. no matter where we are in life? Mm-hmm. And when I look back at everything that I've been through, that day I knew, when I fasted and I prayed, that the reason why God allowed me to go through the pain, the agony, being raised in war, is because God was preparing me to make a difference for my country here in America. Mm-hmm. The dream that became my address. Mm-hmm. I never thought I'd live in my dream, but I am. Yet the Islamists ruined my life in Lebanon have followed me here. And I realized, this is my purpose. I have found my purpose. I can mobilize people. I can speak from personal experience. Mm-hmm. I not only am a terrorism analyst who can talk about terrorism from an intellectual point of view, mm-hmm. but I'm a survivor of Islamic terrorism who lived to tell about it, mm-hmm. and who can speak about it with an authority of some of a survivor, mm-hmm. that is completely differently than somebody who's just studied terrorism in the Middle East in college and wrote a thesis about it and went there for a visit. Mm-hmm. Arabic is my mother tongue. If anybody's going to accuse me of being a racist for discussing these issues, they better be able to argue with me in Arabic, my mother tongue. Mm-hmm. So I knew I was positioned in a way where I can make a difference. I come from a media background. I speak in sound bites. Mm-hmm. I know how the media thinks. I know how reporters think, something that not many people can do. Mm-hmm. And I realized, that is my purpose. My purpose is to mobilize as many Americans as I can and educate them about the threat of radical Islam to world peace and our national security and what we can do about it, while still love them and while still pray for them, mm-hmm. all the Muslims throughout the world. This does not mean we should bury our head in the sand and ignore the problems. The Bible says, be as kind as dove and as wise as serpents. We as Christians have mastered the be as kind as dove part. Because whether we're practicing Christians or not, let's face it, our Judeo-Christian culture, we are raised with the principle of do unto others what you want others to do unto you. Be nice, Johnny. You know, you want to treat people the way you want to be treated. That's how we raise our kids, even atheists who don't even believe in Christ. It's just the principles, the values of our society. Do not judge others lest you be judged. It's just a part of our life. Mm-hmm. And in our case, as Christians in particular, we are not only commanded to pray, mm-hmm. to our enemies and those who hurt us, we are commanded to make a difference in our communities as well. Mm-hmm. Because we are instruments in the hands of God to be used for the better. God does not change the world by just doing lightning in the sky. God changes the world by using his people to make a difference. Mm-hmm. We are here for a purpose, and I found my purpose. So I started traveling and speaking in 2002, worldwide and nationwide. And one question kept coming up. I would speak to groups from 100 to 10,000 at a time in one of those mega churches. And one question kept coming up. Now that I'm educated, what can I do? Give me something to do. Mm-hmm. And that's when I realized education is important, but education by itself is not sufficient. Mm-hmm. Education must be coupled with action. And that's when I launched ActForAmerica.org. ActForAmerica.org. That's the name of our national organization. And I wanted to mobilize people nationwide to get information on how they can become effective. You know, it's like we learn how to pray effectively, how to be a better person, how to serve your community better. We have Bible studies to learn how we are commanded to be better Christians, mm-hmm. so we can understand the Bible better, so we can be used better to, you know, for the kingdom of God. We go to college to learn how to be better at this profession, mm-hmm. so we can practice as professionals. And I realized a lot of people who love this country, want to make a difference for this country, mm-hmm. they just don't know how. Sure. They say, well, what can I do? I don't know where to start. Mm-hmm. I don't know what to do. I'm frustrated about the status quo, but I don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. And so Act for America was founded to give people the tools, the tips, to empower them and give them the tips as to what you can do in your own community.
What a powerful testimony of Bridget when she's saying, I was in Lebanon, I, the The building fell in on me. Blood was pouring in. My own blood was pouring in on my mouth because my arm was over my face. And then she says the very same thing that her father told her parents told her in Lebanon, she ended up telling her own children all these times later. And it's like, when is this going to stop? Well, she's dedicating herself to educating us to help us understand what this issue is. One of our first wars in America was dealing with radical Islam. And the president then was trying to educate America on, you know, what this particular enemy is. And so then you got to check this out. We get back from the break. We're going to go to the Value Voter Summit where Bridget, now why don't you know a little bit about Bridget before you heard her at the Value Voter Summit in Washington, D.C., because she's really going to let it rip, but she's going to educate us quickly on what the dangers that we're facing as Americans and how we need to be educated on being able to maintain our country, maintain the Constitution. Join us after the break.
We'll be right back. January 27th, 1967, Cape Canaveral, Florida.
10, 9, ignition sequence start.
The crew of Apollo 6, 1 5, conducts their countdown 4, rehearsal 3, when suddenly...
2. Oh, no, fire in the cockpit!
Gus Grissom, Edward White, and Roger Chaffee were killed in this tragic event.
A flight never intended to land on the moon, but vital in testing technologies to give NASA information to actually land the first man on the moon by 1970.
Astronauts often brought mementos with them on flights, and it had long been a dream of Ed White to bring a Bible to the moon.
In 1971, Lunar Module pilot Edgar Mitchell landed Apollo 14 on the moon, carrying with him a microfilm of the King James Bible in honor of the Apollo 1 astronauts killed just 4 years earlier. Engage with the Bible and every dimension of its influence.
Brought to you by Museum of the Bible.
You know, a lot of people want to abide with the Lord, but they just don't have a plan to do it. You can request that plan today at iabide.org.
Welcome back to VFNTV with your host, Greg Lancaster.
Wow, is that not amazing? Wow. Seeing Bridget Gabrielle and understand her passion is she was up under the rubble of radical Islam when her whole Lebanon, the country, falls in. I don't know if y'all remember all those battles back then. It was terrible. This is just north of northern borders of Israel. As a matter of fact, when Pat and I were in Israel, we were looking over into Lebanon. You could see the guards there. I mean, radical Islam came in. That's where Hamas, I believe, is located, or Hezbollah. Hezbollah's up there. But now she's in America, and 9/11 happened, and she has to tell her own kids the very same thing. We got to pay close attention because, like she said, you know, people study, or people are theorists, or they have theses on terrorism. But she actually was raised up in a country that lost their country because of terrorism. And that's why they brought her in to the Value Voter Summit, so we could understand how important it is for when we're choosing the values of our next leaders and our leaders. They need to know, they need to be educated about what she's going to share at the Value Voter Summit. Let's join her now.
You know, I read articles before I came here that said about the Values Voter Summit that Brigitte Gabrielle, the Islamophobe, will be speaking. Well, I'm here to tell the press I won't disappoint you. As you very well know, I am not politically correct, so you need to check your sensitivity sleeves out the door. Brigitte Gabrielle has just entered the room. So the big brouhaha in the country for the last week has been Ben Carson and Donald Trump talking about the threat of radical Islam to our national security. And everybody is in a huff, bent out of shape, upset. Everybody's trying to walk on eggshell. And everybody is trying to understand why these two great men are concerned about protecting the United States of America. So for those of you who do not understand why these two men are concerned about it, let me share with you a little bit of the ideology they are concerned about, because that impacts us directly. So what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to crunch 1,400 years of Islamic history in 5 minutes and make it as exciting as I can possibly make it, because I hated history when I was a little girl. At this age, I appreciate history. And now I understand why they say those who don't learn from history are doomed to repeat it. In order for you to understand why Western civilization is very different than the Islamic world, you need to understand the history of Islam. When Prophet Muhammad supposedly revealed his revelation from the angel Gabriel that he is supposed to be the last of the prophets in the early 600s, he started preaching in his own city, Mecca. He tried to recruit friends and followers to be able to spread his religion. And he tried for 12 years and failed. And after 12 years, he was only able to recruit his immediate family and friends. So he decided, if I go to Medina, which was the Jewish hub of Arabia, the business hub where the Jews lived, if I go there and preach my religion to them, if they accept me, that will buy me respect and stature between my own people, and they will accept me. So Prophet Muhammad started borrowing a lot from the Old Testament to make his religion more palpable to the Jews, to make it a lot similar. This is why you see a lot of similarities between Judaism and Islam. For example, Jews don't eat pigs, Muslims don't eat pigs. Jews pray a few times a day, Muslims pray a few times a day. Jews fast on Yom Kippur, Muslims fast on Ramadan. And this is why you started seeing a lot of good writing in the beginning of the Quran when Prophet Muhammad was saying all the good things about the people of the book. He took his message and went to Medina trying to recruit the Jews, talking about the people of the book, talking about how similar the two religions are. When they refused to accept him and follow him as the last of the prophet, that's when he turned against them and started killing them and started expelling them. That's when Islam went from a spiritual movement for the first 12 years of Islam into a political movement cloaked in religion after the year of the Hijra, after Muhammad went to Medina and the Jews did not accept him. He became a military warrior and declared war on them and started expelling them. Jews and Christians became dhimmi, or second-class citizens. They were only allowed to stay alive and not be killed only by paying the jizya, or the protection tax. So they had a choice: convert to Islam, or if you want to stay alive, you have to pay the jizya or protection tax, living as dhimmi in the Islamic nation. Christians and Jews could not ring a church bell. Jews could not blow the shofar. Christians could not ring church bells. They could not pray publicly. Christians and Jews could not gather together and build new churches or new temples. And the way they paid the jizya, or the protection tax, was in a monthly ceremony where they would get together downtown and the Jew would kneel on his knee and hand his goods to the mullah, who would take the goods as the price for buying the protection. And in many areas, Jews and Christians were given necklaces to wear as a receipt that they paid their jizya or their protection tax. Jews considered najis under Islam. Najis is bodily fluid. Najis is garbage. Najis is dogs. Najis is dirty. So Christians and Jews were treated as second-class citizens. Islam continued to grow. As Islam grew, more people became dhimmi, or second-class citizens. Jews and Christians were given identifiable clothing. The yellow star, which was given to the Jews that most people think is a German invention. It was actually an Islamic invention in the 9th century in Iraq by the second Khalif, Khalif al-Mutawakkil of Iraq, who invented the yellow star for the Jews to be identified as they walked down the street. Because Jews were considered najis, if a Muslim man or a Jew walked on the same side of the street, the Jew had to cross the other side so the Muslim man can walk, so he's not dirtied by the filth of the Jew. Christians were given the zunnar, the belt, which most of you men are wearing right now. That was an Islamic invention for the Christians. Islam continued to grow. They went all the way to Jerusalem. They conquered Jerusalem. Christians couldn't ring their church bells in Jerusalem. The Pope in Rome in 1090 told the Christians, how could you sit idly by and allow your brethren to suffer like this in the Holy Land? You need to go liberate the Christians. You need to go help the Christians. That's why the Crusaders were launched. The Crusaders... The Crusaders were not launched because they just felt like waking up in the morning and going and converting a bunch of Muslims or beheading them. The Crusaders were launched to liberate Jerusalem. And they were able to liberate Jerusalem for less than 100 years before Salah ad-Din al-Ayyubi, Saladin, took it back, and Jerusalem remained under Islamic control until 1967, when the State of Israel liberated Jerusalem, where Christians, Jews, and Muslims could pray under the same sky. The Crusaders continued fighting Islam, and for 300 years they tried and failed. And by the 1300s, the Crusaders disappeared because they could not win against Islam. Islam continued to expand. They went all the way to Central Europe. They went all the way to China. They went to India. They conquered Spain. They changed the name of Spain from Spain to Andalusia. And they started, as they advanced, as they conquered more nations, more people paid the jizya or the protection tax. And this is how the Islamic empire grew.
We're going to join this. You're not going to miss one bit of it. Join us after the break. We're going to continue with Bridget Gabrielle's speech at Value Voter Summit. It is awesome.
Wow.
Join us.
We'll be right back.
David Weber from San Angelo, Texas, who's a technical training instructor, wants me to talk about conviction. David, I love this quote. I've said it many times. I think it's very true. One person with conviction is a majority. How many times I've seen a group of people that basically didn't know what they wanted or where they were going, but there was one person in the group they knew. They felt it with passion. They spoke it from the heart. They were determined that that was exactly what they were going to have, and pretty soon other people began to pick up on that conviction. They began to pick up on that passion. And what do you know? Pretty soon that one person with conviction is the majority, and everyone else is following him or her to that desired destination. I've often said to have an answer is a wonderful thing, but to have the conviction of the answer is even more wonderful.
Listen, we are shining the light, keeping the conversation light, on all who want to be in the light, who listen, our audience. That's right. VFN TV and the Daily Radio Program, a network that God is building through your love gift. Sponsor today, partner today, become an underwriter. Go to VFNTV.com and follow the prompt.
Welcome back to VFN TV with your host, Greg Lancaster.
Welcome back. We are listening to Bridget Gabrielle at the Voter Summit. She is the author of Because They Hate. She's a survivor of radical Islam, and she's explaining to us why it's so important when we're choosing our leader coming up. We got to find out and tell them you need to get educated on radical Islam, because this is what it has done and what it's doing. And she just talked about the reason why the Crusaders even came about was trying to free the Christians who were under slavery to radical Islam. Mm. That's why they went down. The Pope said, why aren't you going down there to free your own brothers and sisters down there? And so we're getting educated here. Let's join Bridget Gabrielle, the Voters Summit in Washington, D.C.
This is how the Islamic empire grew. It went all the way until they were stopped at the gates of Vienna on 9-11. 9-11 is not a date that Osama bin Laden just picked out of a hat. 9-11 is a symbolic date in the Islamic calendar. Between the 1600, by the 1600s, Islam had covered more of the earth's surface than the Roman Empire did at its peak. Between the 1600s and the 1800s, the Europeans were experiencing the European Industrial Revolution, where the Europeans were able to invent products on factory lines, where they are able to make money and sell products, which gave them the money to build a strong army in order to fight the Muslims. And that's how they were able to stop them at the gates of Vienna on 9-11. The Europeans started the pushback against Islam. They pushed them out of Europe. They pushed them out of all the way to the Middle East and North Africa. By 1924, The Islamic Empire ended in 1924. The Islamic Caliphate ended in Turkey by President Ataturk, who was a secularist. He ended the Islamic Empire, and he gave women rights to vote. He gave women a right to an education, a right to work, a right to choose a husband. He forbid women from wearing the hijab. He forbid men from wearing the beard. The Muslim hate him so much that they consider him a Jewish agent, because they believe that his mother in her bloodline was Jewish, and that was the influence on Ataturk. By the time the Islamic Empire or the Islamic Caliphate or the Islamic State ended in 1924, the Islamic Caliphate had existed for 1400 years, and it ended less than 100 years ago. By the time the Islamic Caliphate ended in 1924, 270 million people around the world were killed by Islam. 270 million. And we didn't have weapons of mass destruction, and there was nuclear weapons. All of these people were killed, butchered by the sword. The people in the world, less than 100 years ago, how many people knew this history? Please raise your hand. We in America have failed to educate our children about history. We in America failed to educate our population about history. Our children in high school, you take any 17, 16-year-old kid, 18-year-old kid, and ask them about World War II, they can't even tell you what happened in World War II. For them, it's ancient history, and we still have our World War II veteran walking among us. That's how little we know of history. Islam ended in 1924, the caliphate. People thought Islam, the caliphate will never be resurrected. The caliphate will never come back. But two things happened in the Middle East in the last century that made the Islamists be able to resurrect the caliphate. Number one is the discovery of oil in Saudi Arabia, which we were able to discover and were stupid enough to allow them to nationalize it. And the number two that happened was Ayatollah Khomeini coming to power in 1979. That gave the Islamists the money and also the spiritual covering in order to explode on the world stage. And people say, oh, well, the Wahhabis exported their Wahhabi radical religion. The Wahhabis are the name of Wahhab. They're not a different sect of Islam. They follow the authentic preaching of Prophet Muhammad, the way Prophet Muhammad lived and practiced his religion. This is why neither you or me or any infidel can step a foot in Mecca, because as far as they're concerned, we are filth. And as infidels, we're not allowed to step a foot, not President Obama and not anybody else. As a matter of fact, Al-Qaeda used to use Saudi Arabia and its success as an excuse to recruit members, as the example to show them how Allah has blessed Saudi Arabia because of the way they adhered to the tenets of Islam. And today we talk about ISIS. ISIS is not a new invention. ISIS resurrected the caliphate that ended less than 100 years ago. Except we are too ignorant and too uninformed to understand why what ISIS is doing and why ISIS is succeeding.
I'm your host, Greg Lancaster, and we're so glad that you've joined us. Don't forget you can join us 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Download our app and sign up for our newsletter, The Torch, at VFNTV.com. I've enjoyed our time together. God bless.